There are plenty of absurdities and ironies about living in Northern Ireland. I'm sure we could all agree on that, if nothing else. But one of them is that language, which after all is the most fundamental tool of human communication, the shared medium through which we all encounter the world, becomes in itself a source of division and suspicion and alienation. So you know the story of how it goes here. We have the political accommodation at Stormont, and in it the Irish language belongs to nationalists and republicans, while unionists and loyalists must be content with their language, Ulster Scots. Of course, it's a false dichotomy. You know, it's distorted by these competing ideological agendas. Nobody owns language. By its very nature, you know, no one can plant a flag in it and claim exclusive rights to it. But let's talk a bit more about what does happen. Again, you know the story. Republicans, even those, let's be frank, whose knowledge of the language is sketchy or incomplete, have been successful in appropriating Irish as a passionate rallying point and a proud badge of nationhood. Meanwhile, unionists, instead of claiming their own entirely legitimate stake in the shared history of the Irish language, have chosen instead to champion Ulster Scots, which, despite coming under the protection of the Council of Europe Charter, which promotes regional and minority languages, does resemble a dialect rather than a language, and it does lack the credibility and complexity of the Irish language tradition. Now, that's not to say that Ulster Scots and its associated cultural history is without value. Far from it. There's an authentic affection and interest within many Protestant homes for the Hamely tongue, as I believe it's known. But it is my belief that the vast majority of the Loyalist and Unionist population in rejecting Irish, viewing it as something sort of inherently alien, hostile, even as a sort of dangerous countercultural force, that they are depriving themselves of a rich part of their own heritage. More pragmatically, they're also depriving themselves of the opportunity to neutralise the republican appropriation of Irish. If everyone recognised their own history in the timbre of this tongue, any attempts at politicisation would be rendered inert. And one of the things is that you know, quite a few Protestants are surprised to learn that their forebears actually spoke fluent Irish. Just, you know, I don't want to stand here and try and give you a history lesson, but, you know, Protestants made an important historical cultural contribution to the preservation and the development of the Irish language. For example, in 1833, the Presbyterian General Assembly gave its teachers an introduction to Irish, which it described as our sweet and memorable mother tongue. Robert Shipboy McAdam, the 19th century Presbyterian industrialist and Irish language exponent, became famous for welcoming Queen Victoria with a cheerful Erin go brath. And most unionists didn't have any difficulty in identifying with the language until the dramatic politicisation of the Gaelic League by militant nationalism. Douglas Hyde, who resigned the presidency of the movement in 1915, later said that it put an end to my dream of using the language as a unifying bond to join all Irishmen together. So just perhaps Hyde's dream is not entirely dead. You know, as seasoned observers know, one of the most curious aspects of Northern Ireland, despite its polarised nature, is this enduring and sometimes really moving capacity to surprise and to sort of subvert the dominant narratives which define it, which go out around the world. This place has always been more complex and contradictory than, you know, the stark news footage would seem to suggest, you know, the burning cars, the painted curbstones, the rampaging youth. So, and this is what I kind of want to look to in this paper. It is remarkable to consider that right at the very epicentre of the recent protests and riots over the restrictions on the flying of the Union flag, a Protestant Irish language revival has been taking place in East Belfast. Now, I'm sure you know about this. There's been a fair bit of press coverage. I've written about it myself. I had some very interesting conversations with Linda Irvine. She's the sister-in-law of the late Loyalist leader David Irvine, and she's the first Irish language development officer in the east of the city. And she's based over at the East Belfast Mission on Newtonards Road. She told me that she started learning Irish 2 years ago as part of a cross-community project with women from the nearby Nationalist Short Strand. So now she's absolutely just in love with the language, and she's running 5 classes a week delivered by 3 specialist teachers. And the whole scheme is supported by Fóras na Gaeilge, which is obviously the body responsible for the promotion of the Irish language throughout the whole of the island of Ireland. And there's a growing demand for more classes. You know, they just can't get enough. In March, the group participated in Irish Language Festival, and they had the first Irish Language Intensive weekend long course. There's a great momentum building up behind this thing. And Irvine said to me that, you know, she says, what I'm trying to do is to give people in my own community the opportunity to engage with the lost part of their heritage. I want to return that to them. She says, it almost feels like we're giving them permission, perhaps because there's a lingering sense that it's something disloyal. And that's a very interesting word that she used. But she says, now the time's right to connect, reconnect with the language. There's nothing to be ashamed of. And she says, there's always been plenty of Protestants learning Irish quietly. We're just making it visible. So what I think Irvine is doing, especially given the current local political context, which is characterised by such great anger and anxiety over the perceived erosion of British identity, what she's doing requires enormous confidence and conviction. And what I found quite reassuring was that there's no element of acquisitiveness, you know, or attempted exclusivity in the project, no attempt at sort of hands-off protectionism, you know, this is ours now. There's nothing like that going on that I could see. And Irvine said to me herself that she doesn't want to create what she calls a Protestant Irish language utopia in East Belfast. And she does encourage students to visit places like Coulterland on the Falls Road, other places where the Irish language is spoken. And she said, you know, she made a point of saying just how much support that they'd had from within the Irish language movement. And I found out that one of the ways that Protestant people are learning to engage with Irish is by discovering their own family connections with the language. Linda's husband Brian Irvine told me that his brother David learned some Irish alongside other well-known loyalists when he was in jail, but recently he discovered there was already an Irvine family tradition of speaking Irish. He said he went into the 1911 census and he found his grandfather and his two brothers. Apparently they lived in Frome Street, very tight unionist area right in the shadow of the shipyard. And he said, look, these men built Titanic. They went to the Somme, but the census also said that the whole family were Irish speakers. In fact, of the 70 families living on Frome Street at that time, 14 spoke Irish. And he said, it was a revelation to me. There were even more in the Shankill, as many, if not more, than on the Falls. Now, we have to be realistic, of course. A small-scale Irish language revival, even one in the very heart of Loyalist East Belfast, can hardly be said to represent a wider shift in Protestant attitudes to their lost Gaelic inheritance. But it does provide a basis for, I think, a new way of looking at and indeed challenging, you know, the usual painful, bitterly in codes of orange and green. And I think part of the attraction for me is in this sort of affectionate enthusiasm for the process. You know, there's a genuine eagerness to learn the language for its own sake, and to reach out to other Irish speakers, regardless of perceived political orientation. I think that's important. It seemed like an organic thing. This all came because Linda Irvine learned some Irish and found she really loved it. It wasn't imposed, it wasn't artificially imposed. And I think, you know, just maybe to reflect a little bit on what Eamon's been saying already, too often, and it is very well-meaning, I understand that, but too often you see these interventions. And, you know, I think even Johnny was introducing us there, and, you know, I think, Johnny, you said people need reasons to interact. And, you know, sometimes that's true, but what's even better is when people find their own reasons to interact and they're not doing it to some kind of, some sort of worthy agenda, that it isn't being imposed. And it's also done without being overly conscious of the two traditions, which I think is encouraging. So yeah, I think the experience of, I'll wrap up here, like 1 minute ago, the experience of Linda Irvine and her students, I think really shows that depoliticised language and a rediscovered shared history can provide an excellent basis for people just to simply get together and find common ground. And, you know, there's many other ways in which you could take that forward. Of course, there's loads of languages spoken in Northern Ireland now, many more than two or three. And you know, there's just something quite fundamental about learning a few conversational words, even of someone else's language. There's something meaningful in that. It's a way to connect with an experience and a worldview beyond our own. And it is a small gesture, but it's powerful in its own way. It's a gesture of respect. It's a gesture of openness and willing engagement. And that in itself is the antithesis of hostility and suspicion and exclusion. So I guess the real challenge is to see language not as yet another contested space or some kind of crude tool in the cultural carve-up. You know, I'm not saying right now, well, Republicans should learn Ulster Scots. It can't work like that. But it can be a very rich and complex. And, you know, seeing language as this endlessly proliferating entity, which is actually open to everyone. And now, doing that, you know, maybe this is pie in the sky, but, you know, it would require a degree of courage, confidence, generosity and imagination that, you know, is so often lacking in Northern Ireland. And maybe most of all, confidence out of those, because I think confidence is a hell of a lot to do with this. And you know yourself, I mean, the very name of this place is riddled with contention. You know, what do we kind of call it? The six counties, Ulster, the province, or even just here, as opposed to there, presumably. But, you know, the Irish revival in East Belfast, just finding out about that, especially in the context of what's been going on lately, you know, just gives you that little bit of hope. And it does demonstrate that separating language from politics is possible. And it can even be the starting point for all kinds of new and surprising conversations.